Hi, this is David Frangioni, CEO and publisher of Modern Drummer Magazine, Modern Drummer Media, and Modern Drummer Publications. So excited about our new podcast, the Modern Drummer Podcast. This weekly podcast will bring Modern Drummer to life. Sit back and enjoy fresh, fun, and insightful conversations with today's top drummers, producers, musicians, beat makers, and craftsmen. Whether you're a professional, a hobbyist, drummer, musician, programmer, producer, or just love music, this show is for you. Every other week, the Modern Drummer Podcast will feature world-renowned producer, songwriter, and drummer, Narda Michael Walden. Narda Michael Walden's Upbeat is featured exclusively on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
Gregorico!
Look at the dude.
How are you?
Narda, give the drummer some Walden.
I love you, Greg.
Love you too, man.
I'm burning this candle in your honor because the fire you lit in my life.
Thank you, my friend.
When I first heard you and Sly and the Family Stone, it was revolutionary, not only to me, brother, but to the whole world. That was and that fire still burns in me. And I look around my room, I see Prince, who you created.
Yeah.
I see Carlos, who loves you, yeah, right along with you. Yeah. I see Aretha Franklin, who was moved by you and wanted to be down with the funk revolution, which you all went crazy on.
And by her.
Yes. I see Muhammad Ali, who danced to your music. I see Whitney Houston, who jammed to your music. I see James Brown. I see Ray Charles, who also re-inspired by your music.
Yeah.
So, Greg, thank you on this day for being with us. I just want to just thank you for being here. And I want to give you the floor for whatever you want to say to welcome us first today.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, brother. And you are, you have been a reflection of inspiration back to me at times during my life. I can remember moments talking to you during, you know, times that were less active, and you got in my ear and said, man, you know, keep on doing what you did. And
yeah.
So yes. I do what I can, you know.
Yes, brother.
Yeah.
So, Greg, let me ask you, man, as a drummer, you are really a pioneer. I hope that's the right way to say it, because what you stumble upon is magic to this day.
Well, you know, it's just being, you know, at the right place, right time, and just also just inspiration from inside. Just it was there. I mean, I love drums from being a kid. From when I was a little kid, I wanted to get a drum set so bad. Play. Yeah. I just gravitated to it.
Yeah.
The sound, the look. And I listened as I was a kid growing up to a lot of different kinds of music. Growing up in the Bay Area, it being an international intersection, right? And so around the house, my folks didn't want any of that noise, you know? And so I didn't have like support in that manner. So it wasn't until I was 14 that I saved up some money and I bought a kit. And then I started immediately playing with some older guys that lived in the neighborhood, like beer joints and stuff like that, 15 years old. And then I met Freddie, Sly's brother, at 16 through Leon Patilla.
Right.
Who later on sang with Carlton Santana. And then me and Freddie started a band called Freddie and the Stone Souls. And wow, that went about a year. And then Sly was on the radio at the time. He had a radio show. Fantastic radio show.
Yeah.
Very creative and innovative and out of the box, man. And did hip of stuff. And then so he had made a few swipes at starting a group that didn't work for him. And he was going to make one last attempt with just really doing what he was feeling inside, which was different. Okay. And so I showed up for a rehearsal one day for the group I was in with Freddie at Fly's house, because they all lived there, the folks. And we rehearsed downstairs. And they announced at that moment that we're starting a new group tonight. Are you in? You know, they were messing with me because they didn't tell me about this plan, right?
Uh-huh.
So I said, sure. And that's the night, December of 1966, that we all met for the first time.
Okay.
We just talked. We didn't even play that night.
Okay.
We started the next night. We rehearsed for a week and started gigging. But it was just so unique. I mean, we all were just like fascinated by the idea and just the presence of each one of us. It was a magic there from the get-go.
Greg, let me ask you, if I mind to pause you.
Yeah.
This is the time when you were first meeting Sly, correct?
Well, I had met him because we did some gigs together, Freddie and the Stone Souls, and Sly had the Mojo Man.
Okay.
And we had did a few gigs, you know, so I met him just casually. And when Sly was ready to make the move, he came to his brother and he says, bring someone from your group.
Okay.
And he said, I want to bring Greg.
Okay.
And so, I mean, it was just that simple.
Well, what I'm trying to get to is when Sly was with the Mojo Men and you first saw him with his that band, when you first saw him musically, is what I'm trying to get to. What hit you musically when you first saw him play?
It wasn't what he was doing yet.
Okay.
It's what you seen, if you know, you had any kind of intuition at all or anything. I mean, you could see that this, you know, I mean, you listen to his radio show. He was like, here's where he was. He'd be on, he'd sing commercials sometimes, or the weather. He had a piano in the studio and he would play sometimes and do happy birthdays. People would call in, you know, it's my man's birthday, it's my woman's birthday. And he would do stuff like, so one day he's sitting, I think he was doing a commercial, doing the news, and you know, he's at the microphones there, you know, the booth at the radio station. And he looks down, there's a wastebasket right there. And he's looking and he sees Ray Charles. And he looks, and I said, let's go get stoned.
Yeah.
What's that doing in there? Mm-hmm. Bends over, pulls it out, and while something else was going on, he puts it on, spins it. He goes, oh, I'm playing this.
Right, you
know,
right.
Someone, the programmer or whatever, someone, you know, passed on it. And the Bob Dylan tune, right?
Yeah.
And he put that on. He goes, no. We're playing this. He broke that record right there in that seat, meaning right. that it went right. on, got added, so on and so forth. You know, and he was good friends with Tom Donahue, who's the godfather of FM radio and AOR radio, as you know. He right. started the format.
Yes.
Worldwide, actually, beyond the country. And Tom Donahue, Bobby Mitchell. So he had worked for them producing Bobby Freeman this year.
Yes, great records.
What a track record of things, you know. Yeah. But nothing, but it was just like you could see the potential. You could, this, he was so talented. I mean, he could play everything, you know. I mean, so just the thought of the writing chops weren't all the way developed, although he did write, you know, Right to Swim, and he produced
the Buell Brummels.
Buell Brummels, and Grace Slick, and the what was it called? Something Society. Mm-hmm. This was before Jefferson Airplane.
Okay.
And then the Bull Brummels.
Yeah.
And for Rich Romanello, who owned a place called the Winchester Cathedral, who was our first manager. That's the first place we went to play.
Okay.
We play there after hours. So, I mean, you could see all the potential in the Bay Area, San Francisco. Yeah. I was like a pimple ready to pop. I mean, it was always all this unique, different talent. Nothing came out of here, though. It was all New York or Los Angeles.
That's where,
where the business was, you know.
Right,
that's where you went and you got into it. San Francisco was off the map still. But the talent and the inspiration and the magic was here, you know, ready to be seen. And
yes.
You know, the rest is shortly after that. What became of the San Francisco sound and all the bands and musics that came out of here was all different. You know, it's all
right.
Like in place.
It's incredible. I want to kind of move a little bit forward to, I would be in Plainmoor, Michigan, and there was a TV show, a national TV show, and it became the Battle of the Bands. And for people where I live, it was a big deal because here it had whittled down to the Chambers Brothers against Sly and the Family Stone as who would be the best band in America. We all had to watch that show. Do you remember that?
I remember. I have it. I remember. We were playing in New York City at a place called geez, what was that? I can't think of the name, but we're talking, we want to get my age away. Man. I just turned 72, brother.
Yeah, know? I know.
Anyway, so the Electric Circus.
Yeah.
In the Village.
Okay.
Jimmy used to hang out with us there. And I mean, it was great. It was right around the corner, actually, for Bill Graham's Phil Maurice. And so we were playing there, and it, all of a sudden this happened real quick. We got to do this gig. We got to fly. And we were supposed to play that night again back in New York City, but we arranged to fly out and come back, which it ended up being, there was a storm and we couldn't land. And we did make the gig eventually, but we were late and it was chaotic. But I remember going there. I remember doing the show. And like I said, I got a video of it too. And and we won like $10,000 or something.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
Yeah. And they were our buds too. We used to do gigs, a few gigs together, you know, and then all of a sudden we're in this contest. You know, it was just, no.
I thought that was a great title to be able to say the best band in America. I mean, America has some badass bands, so to be the best band was like, damn.
I didn't even know that. You know.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, you were the best band in America. And then, of course, we saw you like that.
Yeah.
Can you see this?
Yeah.
And your shoulder would always be up like that. Yeah. Tell me, how did you develop this style of playing, Greg? Talk to me about your style.
I didn't, you know, I'm self-taught, so everything I did just came from feeling it.
Okay.
And so I didn't have any technique in the beginning. I practiced this stuff, but I didn't know, I mean, any rudiments or anything. I went and learned that later on after I did. Matter of fact, you
were
the first one to tell me, hey, Greg, that song, you can make it if you try it. Man, that thing you do, that paradiddle you do between your foot and the left hand.
Yeah.
What paradiddle? And you go, yeah, that's a, you're doing a paradiddle.
I go,
you know, I never thought about that. You know,
for me, it was very obvious that you were like taking rudiments. I mean, just stark rudiments, and bringing them into the hood. Yeah. Where it was now, you know, it was swinging. It's like, damn, this is the only guy I've heard take just dead up rudiments and make them hits.
Well,
No one else had done that, man.
If you think about drumming and rhythms and where that comes from, that's a very humanistic, deep, way back. I mean, I really believe that actually rhythm and drumming, percussion, was one of the first human languages.
Yeah.
And where I'm coming from is if you go back and to where there were tribes and how one tribe communicated with the other.
Right.
Before language, and I'm talking way back.
Yeah.
It was either smoke or banging on something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And by those rhythms, you could kind of feel whether they're having a celebration or they're having a barbecue or they're going to barbecue you.
That's right. You know? Okay.
So my point was that rudiments started from, they didn't come from, it was no, you know, not from books. I mean, you know, fast forward into the future, and as things move on and people start becoming, you know, really into their craft, and when books start being read and rudiments and music started being notated and all that, you know, those rudiments came from somewhere first, were written down, had somewhere, someone did it.
Yes.
And these are all things that are inside of us.
Yes.
So, you know, you go down and listen to the rhythms, you know, coming from Africa and down in the islands and all that stuff, where most of that came from Africa, you know. You'll find a trail of these things we call rhythms, you know.
Yes. Greg, man, I've seen you live only once back at that time. It would be during the time of like either 69 going towards 70, maybe 69. At a peak of sound, where I saw you in a like an amphitheater in Chicago, where the amphitheater would kind of go up, you would be down, and we'd be going sitting up, looking down upon you, and the sound was massive. It was so together, Slide and Family Stone. But one moment, as prison on my brain, where Larry hits a pedal. And the sound in the whole place was like deep, deep bass. A thing we had never heard. It was a fuzz tone, but deeper than anything we ever heard with you on the drums going at it.
Yeah.
And I was like, it was revolutionary. We had never seen anything like it. No. I mean, it was not just Slide anymore. It was you and Larry.
Yeah.
What you guys made was just like bread and butter that we had to have.
We had a wonderful chemistry. Right?
Yes. Speak about that.
Yeah. We didn't discuss or sit down and game plan on any of that stuff we did. It was just, we had a good chemistry and we never talked about it. And we just did it together.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, then later on, and when people started talking about them, we realized we had a thing going on. We left it alone. We didn't go, and start trying to figure it out. We stayed out of its way, and it was wonderful and powerful. Mm-hmm. We just did it, and you felt that, okay, this isn't broke. Let's not fix this.
Mm-hmm. How instrumental was Sly with the drum parts that he might want you to play on different songs?
Well, there was times where there was something that he was hearing that he was sick, or even, play this. Mm-hmm. And there were times that we even argued sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I got it, and sometimes he got it.
Okay.
We had a pretty natural feel, especially after we kind of developed our sound. It was pretty didn't need much discussion,
Right.
And for instance, Thank You, which is a powerful, funky track.
Right? Yes, right.
So I could play you 10 versions that have nothing to do with each other. In other words, that song, he was really digging for something and hearing something. When we finally got the basic track, he said, I'm going to take off for about 2 weeks. You ain't going to see me. I'm going to the studio. And when I come out, I know I'm going to bring what I'm hearing.
Okay.
And he did. He disappeared for a couple of weeks, went in the studio and put all his guitar parts and, the two guitar parts and bass part. And when he came out and he played that for me, I just got goosebumps, man.
Right.
And I mean, as the developing, the morphing of that track was all over the place.
Yes.
But it found its way.
Oh, genius. Absolute genius. Another thing I did not know until you told me recently, which I think is mind-blowing, so much of the things that you did that are historical were things you actually would record but then overdub again.
Well, so here's how that went. On all the singles, not the album cuts, but okay. Our singles over the time of our songbook.
Right.
We cut the tracks, go in and go over the vocals and do horn parts and all that. And then the last thing that would be done before mixing is I'd go back in, put some cans on. There was no drum machine or click tracks back then. Put some cans on and record the drums again to sometimes this new arrangement or new feel, or even. I mean, the song had morphed,
Yeah.
So, and every one of them. Thank you. Hot Fun in Summertime, Everyday People. Sex Machine was the only album cut that I did because I overdubbed the drum solo at the end. But I think I did the whole track again too, because I remember cutting it doing that shuffle in there. I can remember doing that over. That's the only album cut. The rest were all original tracks, but the singles, I would record the drums as the last thing again and just really tune in onto the verses, the choruses, the breakdowns, whatever it required. Yes. And then it makes it.
Greg, there's so much made of like a Jeff Porcaro on his feel on, say, like Rosanna or things that he does because of his feel. But when you look at the feel of like Hot Fun in the Summertime, it's so brilliant. Your feel.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't talk about it. That's why I'm talking to you right now. Your feel, what comes out of your heart, is so magical.
Yeah.
Speak about Hot Fun, man.
Look what I was surrounded with.
Yes. Yes.
And Sly and Freddie. I mean, but actually Jeff Porcaro mentioning that, Jeff did talk about Hot Fun. And he talked about that song and that he was thinking that was inspiring the more he did.
See, I'm right. There's a connection. I can feel it. I can feel it. The way you hit your stairs and the little sweet things inside there.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful. Yeah. God, man, what a life. What a life. What a life. Well, I have a few things I want to touch upon because it's just so monumental. Woodstock. Just say something about Woodstock. Anything you want.
Woodstock was a one-of-a-kind event, a very special event. That's why people are still talking about it. You were at Woodstock.
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to tell me about that. And it's just, it has that for just people hearing about it and just seeing the film or listening to the album, because you could feel this magical moment in time that existed there. I mean, and from the moment we came in a helicopter because the roads were blocking, you couldn't get in. So I remember coming over the hill. I was in one of those army helicopters, those big beluga thing with there was no wall. It was just a fiberglass strap. It was frightening as hell.
Right.
Anyway, so we're coming in, I could see, I didn't even know what it was. I seen this kind of a haze and all this, it's people. Mm-hmm. First part as you could see, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you could feel it landing. You could smell it. You could feel it. And I walked around a little just to check it out and feel the vibe. It was just amazing. I mean, everything about it, it touched it. But, you know, a lot of people didn't want to do that.
Right. So,
because at the time, outdoor festivals weren't fun. Mm-hmm. Production is not like it exists today back then. You know, there's no tarps over, you know, so you could get rained on or the sun's beating you and it's dusty, windy, raining, all the elements. Sound wasn't that good, you know. The sound was big there, but the monitor systems, you know, they weren't. Matter of fact, in those days, we all had like part of our sound was because we used big sound. We got our own sound on stage. We brought it with us, our amps.
Right.
Larry had like 8. I forgot what he was using at the time. Like, I had 2 dual Showmans and a Shure microphone just for my bass drum.
Whoa!
Yeah, so, because Sly said, I want to hear that bass drum. Okay, so this is what I did. So I brought that. So it didn't matter how the system fell short. On stage, we were pushing air.
Wow! I love hearing this.
And I put that right. I put the mic on the front side. The kick side, so I got the snare and the kick too.
Wow. So,
you know, you could hear it on stage, everybody getting, you know, so that we created that train sometimes.
What about your hearing for the band? I mean, were you able to always hear the band?
Well, I could hear, you know, I mean, I could hear Larry.
Okay.
So we're locked. I usually could hear his Leslie's. He had 8, I think, stacked up right on both sides of it, you know. So, you know, we made sure that we heard each other and we heard enough. Sometimes I couldn't hear the horns, maybe, unless they were, you know, or even the vocals that much. You know, like I'm hearing ambience from the side fills or something. Like I said, the monitor systems weren't like they are now, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
In ears now, so I could hear everything, low volume.
How about your energy? Were you huffing and puffing because you gave so much? Acceleration of height?
When we get off stage, we lost 5 pounds.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, Larry and I were always dripping wet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The way it was.
That's right.
You know, it was just high energy. I mean, when you went in, have you ever seen the, I think it's Mount Vernon in Harlem, that outdoor park? We did it just around the same time as Woodstock.
No, I don't know that one.
You know, Questlove is doing he's directing a movie, and it's called The Black Woodstock, and it's that show. I got video of it off the show to you.
Okay,
very cool. And Sly and this was shortly after Woodstock, and it's pretty interesting to just see how this thing unfolds, like with the crowd. You know, we had already played the Apollo, I think, once or twice, but this was like 15,000, 20,000, you know, people from Harlem were there to see this. And they came to check us out.
That's right. That's right.
See, I mean, it's just so interesting. And then you know, it was hard, hardcore. Mm-hmm. But we knew what we were going to do with the audience because this is what we did. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no black and white. There was no, you know, it's just people and it's just fundamental music.
Powerful. Is this the same festival that Jimi Hendrix played as well?
No, he didn't. But I didn't know at the time, but I come to find out that that went on for a couple weekends. And like, it was, I think Aretha played there and mm-hmm. Ray Charles and all kinds of people. And you know, I bet it was just this one day. But it's pretty cool. I'm interested to see what Amir does with it. I think it was great performance. And
I want to speak about another
interesting social thing too. Yes. You know?
Yes. Yes. Good. I want to speak about the social side of things, because at that time you were an interracial band playing such heavy funk music. Mm-hmm. To a lot of us, it was like, wow, they've come together. They're showing the unity of America, the best of America. You look at a shot like this, it shows you guys, you know, coming together. And then I want to ask something that's going to be kind of radical. At that time, you put out a song called Don't Call Me Nigger Whitey, Don't Call Me Whitey Nigger, to break down the stereotypes, to just crash it.
Yeah.
Speak about it, because here we are now in 2020, still dealing with racism.
It's unbelievable. It may be even worse than it was then, you know, in some ways. It was, well, that night that we got together in December of 1966, I'm telling you, was when we all look at each other in the room. Man, well, this is interesting. And at that time, there were racial challenges going on, social things, you know, the war, Vietnam, all kinds of stuff. And we're going to put together males, females, and black and white. And everyone's telling us, you can't do that. I mean, when we met that night for the first time, there was no thought about you can't. There was no challenge about this ain't going to work or anything. We could feel it. We hadn't played a note yet. Mm-hmm. You could feel it. You know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we took the challenge and brought it. Brought a statement that was really cool, really mm-hmm. powerful. And, yes. You know, I think it's still, you know, along with Sly's writing group, and the statement that the band made, especially at that time, you know, it's still when people are exposed to it again, they get it.
It's yes.
Like, oh, mm-hmm. I got to think about this.
Yes. You know, I have to just tell you, brother, that so much of what you've done with that band, as much as James Brown's music has done, as much as Ray Charles' music has done.
Yeah.
The music of Sly and the Family Stone is part of our fabric to the core, to the core. And I just want this moment to just not only thank you, but thank you, because it's because of you and people who are like you that I'm able to sit here today and be here.
Well,
I just got to say it.
That's inspiring to hear that coming from you, who's cut himself a pretty large path and impressive and done a lot of music and a lot of great people. And a lot of the artists you ended up working with are some of the ones I listened to in the early days that inspired me. And thank you back.
Yeah. Okay, two things I want to touch upon. One, you play in the Haleakala Crater with Neil Sean. And is it Dougie Rauch on bass or somebody hot on bass?
No.
I forget who it was.
Well, we did two shows. We did a live album with Santana, with myself and Buddy Miles.
Yep. And, staggering, by the way, staggering. Yeah. That's the first time I heard Neil Sean with you guys. Staggering.
Neil.
Damn.
So then I think it was, I'm not sure if it was the year before. I think it was the year before maybe. Or maybe the year after, 72 or 73, Neil and I had a trio, and the bass player was Pete Sears.
Okay.
Pete Sears, who actually played keyboards with He was with
Jefferson Starship, the Starship Band.
Well, he played Starship. He played bass mostly with the Starship. Anyway, we had a trio. It was a crazy, just the energy was just, it was explosive trio, and we couldn't find a singer. Matter of fact, I remember we tried to get a hold of Stevie Winwood from a phone booth. And we tried, you know, reaching out to different people. And it just was, it would have been cool if we would have got a good singer, you know, at that time, because the energy, you've probably seen, there's a piece of video, I think, it's audio.
Yeah. Craig, there's audio of you, Neil, and I don't know the bass player's name, forgive me. Neil will tell me when I see him. But it was,
Pete Sears.
Okay. It was just so raw.
Yeah.
Deep. Deep funk, and you were hitting so powerfully and so great. It just marked my soul.
Yeah. It was that, you know, that energy that I had experienced, you know, in the development of Sly and the Family Stone. And then everywhere that I went, I kind of took that. I knew that I had to bring that, whatever the music was.
Yeah.
Because I had an opportunity to go out with like the weather report, like you did too. And, you know, Joe and Wayne, I mean, just amazing. You know, that was a very high point experience musically for me. And even they were just fun to be with and travel with. This was after Sly.
Yeah.
I went out with them and it was a totally different experience. And it really filled, it created a place, you know, in my life that I didn't even know existed.
Well, think about this. Boom, boom, da-ga-da. Boom, boom, da-ga-da. Boom, boom, da-ga-da. Boom, boom, da-ga-da. Boom. Speak about that. Go on, man.
Oh, we just, I remember the first time going back. Well, Dougie Rouch, because you spoke about him, he was living with me for a while. And so did Pete Sears, too, when he first came from England. And anyway, I had a little studio downstairs, and we used to jam all the time. And Dougie goes, hey, this bass player, friend of mine, I want to bring him over. He actually plays upright though, but I think this would be cool. Could I bring his name is Miroslav Vitos.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know, you know, and he came and he brought him over and we jammed a bunch of times. He just went on for a couple of weeks, you know, and then one night Miroslav says, hey, Joe's looking, we got a tour coming up. He's looking for a drummer. Would you like to come out? And I'll tell you the truth, I wasn't familiar with the music yet. I had heard Weather Report. I was hearing a lot of things about it, but I hadn't listened to anything yet. And I just accepted because I was, you know, I dug him and we were jamming some cool stuff and we were having fun. And I remember going to New York and the first gig was at that, was it A.B. Fisher Hall? I forget the name of the place in New York, and we played. It was a show with Diodato, and he had 2001 Space Odyssey out.
Right, okay.
And we just got together in his loft, a couple of days before. I remember I met Hayerto for the first time. He had just come with Floor with his wife coming from South America, you know, and we rehearsed not extensive, and it was just more about. You know, he would set up a tune. And so there would be an entrance and an exit. And everything that happened in the middle was that moment.
That's right.
And you just went for it.
That's right.
I was like a kid in a candy store. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, and wow. I had a big fives, I think they were called. Fiberglass. I had a big rock and roll set, 24-inch bass, you know, four toms, you know, and they were loud. And it wasn't like the jazz set with the 20. And, you know, this was like, so Dom Romão played percussion, wonderful percussionist, and he had a little jazz set. So there was a lot of times where he'd jump on the set while I'm playing and we would play. We'd weave in and out, you know, or play against each other. And it just was, it worked crazy. This was some good black market recordings of some of those shows.
Yes. Well, man, that groove in particular, there's a box set out now where they have the long version of that boom, boom, da, boom, boom, da, and they're all just jamming it. Yeah. That's a long version they got out.
Yeah.
Greg, you sound great, man. You sound just great, man.
Thank
God.
You.
Well, let's come to now, Greg. Here we are, 2020, September 22nd. I know you had a birthday recently. You're Virgo. Happy birthday.
September 1st. Thank you.
Happy birthday to you, man.
Yeah, thank you.
And anything you...
Did you? You just had one also.
Me? No, I'm April 23rd. Taurus, yeah.
Taurus passed, yeah.
Yeah, April 23rd.
Right.
So, Greg, man, anything you want to say about now and going forward for our future, for our listeners, for our fans, people who love you, anything you want to put out in the world at this time, go right ahead.
Oh, just give back some of the love that was given to me that I realized during, it was the 80s or when computers first came out. There was this guy that started a fan page. I didn't even know what a computer was yet. And long story short, he had got a hold of us and kind of, you know, befriended us. And he came out to visit. And he said, I'm going to bring you a computer. I'm going to show you what this is all about, you know, about internet or, you know, messages or anything. And he got me into it. And then fast forward a little bit to where, you know, email and all that stuff. And now people could access you and send you messages. And I started getting all these things. And I never realized that gave me more of a realization of the impact that the band had and what we did back then in the late 60s, early 70s, than just the success that we had, you know, being on Ed Sullivan Show or whatever, or all the people cheering at a show, you know, that's one thing. But when you get a personal note from someone, it's telling you, Greg, you know, you inspired me either to play or you made this time in my life just higher than it was without it. And those kinds of things, it's touching, man. And it's inspirational. It's inspiration back. And it affected me in a big way to you know, get back into it and embrace all that again, you know?
Yes, Greg.
Like probably all us drummers, I'm sure, you know, if you've been around long enough, you went through those highs and those lows, you know?
Right.
So thanks for the love, everyone.
Always. Oh, Greg, God bless you, man. For some reason on my mind also is to say, whatever you can say, there was a great recording engineer who you worked with named Don Pulse.
Oh,
P-U-L-S-E. Yeah. He gave me a beautiful award and told me he worked with you. And we don't talk about him too much, but he was the man making that great sound with you, those drum sounds and all that. Anything you want to say about your sound with Don Pulse from the studio side of things?
Yeah, I could, a little quick experience on that. And so back in those days, this is when groups first started getting signed and recording. So there was this whole new challenge for all the pro engineers who were used to the studio guys coming in. These were seasoned studio players. And two challenges. That's one. So they had their way and it was, you know, what we were doing was very unorthodox. You know, it wasn't the set standard of what you would do. And then also at that time, I could say that probably Sly was one of the first to mix the drums out in front.
Yes.
And the drums weren't like a background rhythm, just keep time, dude, kind of thing. It's a whole different ballgame. So you had both of those things. And I didn't have studio chops. I mean, I learned them, but when I first came, so getting with these wonderful engineers, a guy like Don, they kind of realized what they came to see the group live first, you know, it was Clive had signed us, right? And so they seen, oh, this is different. This is going to be a challenge, but come on, let's bring it. And so we go in the studio, you know, you're kind of learning what you're dealing with, this new medium, and it's a whole different animal. Playing live and making records are two different things. And it was a wonderful experience. College, that was the university I went to, and learned a lot, and even learned just a quick with that being said, making records, and then once they were, you know, the public is used to them, they want to hear that song, would you go play live? Sometimes you brought it verbatim as you recorded it, and sometimes you couldn't do that to make the song work. To make a live performance, you had to change it up, flip it, whatever that might have, you know, it's, there's no set thing of what that meant, but you just needed to feel it and do that, make that adjustment. And so I learned a lot from that whole experience, from all that, you know, making records and playing live, and then, you know, going from clubs to theaters to big, you know, outdoor, big, huge venues, where each one of those was a different challenge to make the songs work, to make the performances work.
You know, there's a young girl, I just saw her recently on the YouTube, named Sina, S-I-N-A. She plays drums. She's very good. She's a young girl. She's very, very pretty. And she's such a fan that she'll take like Ringo Starr's, you know, Beatles stuff. And she'll break it down how he's playing different things for different songs. It'd be lovely to ask Sina to do a thing on you. And break it down, the different songs, why you chose these different things to play on these different songs.
Yeah, and that, all that is just being conscious of that, what you just said. Just be conscious. Just be considerate of each thing is a different creation. And you know, if you're going to bring, you have to bring what it needs. Yeah. It's telling you what it needs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. Ears. Yeah, listening.
Yeah, there's a lot of great young male and female girls, boys playing stuff now, drums, bass. I see this little kid playing bass, man. He must have been 5 years old. He's like, dude, you know, then playing groove, you know, I mean, just amazing. There's some great female drummers. Cindy.
Yeah, of course.
One of your friends, too.
That's right, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. She's amazing, you know. Yeah. And young drummers, you know, I've seen 4 or 5 years old from different countries. And it's just, it's great. Music, powerful. It's really good, inspiring to see these young kids. Those are the ones that are going to change the world.
That's right.
The adjustments that need to be made, you know.
That's right. That's right. Great.
You can see all this stuff all over my drums. I just got the EAD, you know, you hear about that? It's just a little piece of software hardware, and you clip. Check this out. It's amazing.
Okay.
So you clip this onto your bass drum. It's got a stereo configuration microphone inside that. Okay. That's it.
Yeah.
And here's the piece of, and here's the little, you know, the controller. And you turn it on. And it sounds like you've been in the studio for about 4 or 5 hours and the engineer has been working on your sound. It starts there. I'm telling you. And then you got effects. You got the effects and, you know, it's got a trigger on the bass. You can add trigger to old sampled sounds. It's just amazing.
I love it.
Yeah. So anyway, I've just got it. And Michael Shreve and David Garibaldi turned me on to it. Did I mention to you about Stick People?
You did. You mentioned privately, but tell all our listeners. Go ahead.
So Stick People is five drummers from the Bay Area during the musical renaissance of the late 60s, early 70s that were in iconic groups. And so we've gotten together 3 times a week, an hour and a half each time since the end of February. And there's no script, no agenda. It's not about playing. We're talking about our experiences, about, you know, recording a certain song, touring with this guy, life, everything and anything. Mm-hmm. And it's just been fabulous. And quite frankly, I mentioned early on that, dudes, this is our therapy, you know, during these times.
Yeah.
And it's just been wonderful. And we have guests on now. We're going to have you on hopefully pretty soon.
Love to.
And just talk. Yeah. Like I said, no script, no agenda, no nothing. We're just talking. Just
okay.
We have a lot of fun.
Okay. Greg, I want to thank you again, man. You look wonderful. You're alive as always. And I so appreciate you and so love you. And on behalf of everybody in the world that could say hello to you at this time, I just want you to really feel our love for you. what you have put down and what you have, and what you do put down is the pure fabric of the funk and the life that we know in music. So thank you for that.
I appreciate you, and I thank you too.
Okay. Greg and Mika, everybody, we love you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Shop Talk section. This is Mike Dawson, Managing Editor for Modern Drummer. This week, we are going to be taking a look at and listen to the Paiste Sound Formula 602 editions that we reviewed back in the September issue of Modern Drummer. So if you're not familiar with the 602 formula by Paiste, this was the, I don't know if it was the original Paiste line, but it's been around since 1959. It is the first high-end cymbal line that the company put out. They were made from B20. So really, this is kind of the classic Paiste sound of the 60s, 70s, before the 2002 series was introduced. So back in 2011, the Formula 602s were reintroduced, and they focused on some of the thinner models, the classic sounds. So then earlier this year, they updated the line, so we got a whole batch of stuff to check out. We have, what do we get? We got some 15-inch Sound Edge hi-hats, 14 and 15-inch heavy hi-hats, 17 and 19-inch thin crashes, a 20-inch paper thin crash, and then 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20-inch medium crashes, 16, 18, and 20-inch heavy crashes, and a really wild 13-inch heavy bell. So these are designed, I mean, the paper thin obviously fills out the classic thin sound, but it's a 20-inch, so it's a big crash. But then we have all these heavier models to, you know, give you a little bit more punch for the series. So what we're going to do in these demos, I've got, you know, I try to group them by sizes. So the first thing we're going to check out is the 20-inch models. So you'll hear the paper thin, the heavy, and then the medium. If you're watching the video, the paper thin is all the way on the left. The heavy is in the rod cymbal position, and then the medium is on the right. Let's check those out. Right, so the 20-inch, it was the most kind of crash-only sound. I felt like the paper-thin was the one for me that was just sound like a crash, a big, nice, big crash, kind of classic, thin, glassy, little bit of complexity, real expressive. But the 20 and, I mean, sorry, I keep messing it up, the heavy and the medium, to me, just sounded like they could be rides or they could be heavy crashes, which is probably why Paiste only marks these as paper thin, medium, and heavy. They don't put the word crash or ride on any of these. So you kind of can do whatever you want it to do. All right, so let's move down a size. We're going to do 19-inch thin and medium. So the first one is the thin, the second one is the medium, and let's check them out. That thin sounds beautiful. I think I could use that on pretty much any situation. The, you know, the medium I think would be for me. So I'd need to have a really hard hitting situation for that to work, but still they both sound great. So that's some options. Now let's move on to, we've got the 18. So these are 18 inch medium and an 18 inch heavy. So these are both going to be, you know, the heavier models. Again, check out how versatile they are as a ride and also as a crash. Here we go. 18-inch medium first, 18-inch heavy second. Let's keep rolling. We've got the 17-inch thin and the 17-inch medium. Spoiler alert, the 17-inch thin to me is textbook perfect crash cymbal. So here we go. 17 thin, 17 medium. Now we have the 16s. These are both heavier. So we've got a 16-inch medium and a 16-inch heavy. Let's get to that funky 13-inch heavy bell. So this thing is, it's a beast. So let's just check it out. 13-inch heavy bell. So it's a small cymbal with a giant bell. You can imagine what it sounds like, but let's check it out. 13-inch heavy bell. All right, let's shift into hi-hat mode. So we're going to go with the 14-inch heavy hi-hats first. These surprised me. I didn't expect them to be as expressive and nuanced because they're called heavies, but I shouldn't be surprised. That's what Pisces is known for. So here's the 14-inch heavy Formula 602 hi-hats. Now we've got the big 15-inch heavy hi-hats. Same thing. I was really surprised how expressive and musical these things were. Here they are, the 15-inch Formula 602 heavy hi-hats. And then last but not least, we have the 15-inch SoundEdge hi-hats. If you're not aware of what the SoundEdge hi-hats are, the bottom cymbal is rippled on the edge, which is to prevent some airlock that can happen if the cymbals hit parallel. And it also, kind of brightens up the sound in a way. So let's just check them out, the 15-inch SoundEdge Formula 602 hi-hats. So there you have it, the new Peisty Formula 602 editions. I hope you got something out of this segment. Please like, share, subscribe, whatever you need to do to get this podcast out to the world. And we will see you next week. Have a good one.
Thank you, everybody, for watching this week's Modern Drummer Podcast. Stay tuned for next week's episode exclusively on Podcast One. Until then, stay safe and healthy. And thanks for listening and watching.